Well, good afternoon, and thank you, Josh, and thank you to the Australian Securitisation Forum for their kind invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. Today, I thought I'd provide an update on developments in the markets for housing and the markets for housing credit. These markets are closely related, and both are of considerable interest to those that issue and those that invest in Australian residential mortgage-backed securities, or RMBS. Along the way, I'm going to make use of data on residential mortgages from RMBS that are eligible for repurchase operations with the Reserve Bank. Among other things, these data are a useful source of timely information on interest rates that people are actually paying loan by loan. And as I'll demonstrate, this allows us to infer something about the shifts in the supply of and the demand for credit, and thereby shed some light on different forces driving these housing markets and housing credit markets. Anyway, with this background in mind, I'll also review some recent developments in the RMBS market, and I'm going to finish by taking the opportunity to emphasise that RMBS issuers and investors, I think, should be prepared for any future changes in the use and the availability of benchmark interest rates. So, as highlighted recently in a speech by the Deputy Governor, Guy DeBell, the markets for housing and housing credit are going through a period of significant adjustment. After years of strong growth, housing prices have been declining nationally, driven by falls in Melbourne and Sydney over the past year or so. Also, there's been a noticeable decline in investor credit growth and an easing in owner-occupier credit growth. As you can see here, the cycles in the overall growth of overall housing prices and investor credit have moved together quite closely over the past few years. And underpinning these changes, there have been shifts in the demand for and the supply of housing, as well as in the demand for and supply of housing credit. The links between these two markets, as I've suggested, run in both directions, so from housing credit to the housing market, but also back again from the housing market to housing credit. And of late, the story more commonly told, at least the one I hear most commonly, is that a tightening in the supply of credit over recent years has impinged on the demand for housing. Now that's the story that's the more apparent one in terms of its causes and effects. In particular, the measures implemented by regulators over recent years to address the risks associated with some forms of housing lending have worked to mitigate those risks, but they've also led to a noticeable slowing in investor credit. And this in turn has contributed to a decline in the demand for housing. Again, these links have been discussed by Guy DeBell, and they're well documented in the bank's recent financial stability review. In late 2014, APRA, they set a benchmark for investor lending growth at each bank of no more than 10% per annum. And then in March of 2017, APRA announced it would also require interest-only loans, which are disproportionately used by investors, to be less than 30% of each bank's new lending. Over the same period, several other measures were implemented, including to tighten up the ways in which banks assess the ability of borrowers to service their loans, and to limit the share of loans that constituted a large portion of the value of the property being purchased. Now, banks responded to these requirements in two key ways. First, for some years now, they've been tightening lending standards, thereby reducing the availability of credit to higher risk borrowers. And second, banks raised interest rates for new and existing borrowers, first on investor loans from 2015, and then on interest-only loans in 2017, as you can clearly see here. In other words, the banks tightened the supply of credit, but most notably for investors. Now, the Financial Stability Review we published recently presents estimates of the effect of APRA's first round of regulatory changes from 2014. And the key conclusions from that analysis are that, with the introduction of that 10% investor credit growth benchmark, First, the composition of new lending shifted away from investors and towards owner-occupiers, but with little change in overall housing loan growth. And second, housing prices have grown more slowly in regions with higher shares of investor-owned properties. So that's the story that emphasises the effect of the prudential measures on the supply of credit and, in turn, the effect of tighter credit supply on the demand for housing. But I now want to draw your attention to the story less often told about the important causal link going in the other direction. In particular, the correction in the housing market, at least over the past year or so, appears to have been impinging on the demand for credit. And there are a number of reasons for the ongoing adjustment in housing prices. As I've just said, there's the reduction in the supply of credit. There's the large increase in the supply of new housing associated with the high levels of housing construction, particularly in Brisbane, Melbourne, and Sydney. There's the weaker demand from foreign buyers, and that's due in part to stricter enforcement of Chinese capital controls, but also various policy measures, including at a state level across Australia, that have made it more costly for foreign residents to purchase and then hold on to housing. And last, and by no means least, there's the very substantial growth in housing prices over a long period. And that had pushed up housing prices to record levels as a share of household incomes and raised the prospects for a correction. And just in support of this last point, because I think it's an important one, I'd note that, as you can see here, housing prices in Melbourne and Sydney, and they had increased by around 55 and 75% respectively to their peaks since 2012. Those two cities are currently experiencing larger declines in housing prices than in Brisbane, where housing prices had risen by a modest 20% from 2012 to the recent Brisbane peak. And you can also see here it's worth noting that housing prices are currently rising in Adelaide and Hobart. And in addition, in Melbourne and Sydney, house prices had run up further than apartment prices, and it's now house prices that have declined the most. While there may have been numerous causal factors, after a period of slowing housing price growth, and more recently, it's become clear that housing prices are in decline in a number of major markets. And this dynamic would have weighed heavily on the minds of buyers, but particularly investors, whose only motivation for buying is the return on the asset. An expectation of even a modest capital loss provides quite a strong incentive for them to delay buying a property, particularly in an environment of relatively low rental yields. But how can we assess the role of the different factors that I've talked about affecting credit supply versus those that are affecting credit demand? Well, changes in the price of credit, in other words, interest rates, that can help us. Other things equal, a fall in the supply of credit relative to demand can be expected to be associated with higher interest rates on housing loans. In contrast, a fall in the demand for credit relative to supply should be associated with a decline in interest rates. And I just want to be crystal clear on this point, so let me belabor it a little bit further by saying I'm talking about credit supply and credit demand curves shifting, if you remember back to your early economics. The former by itself, so the shift in supply reduces quantities. So these curves are shifting inwards. And the former, the shift in credit supply inwards by itself reduces quantities while prices rise as the equilibrium shifts up the demand curve. And if we think about the other one, the shift inwards of the demand curve reduces quantities also, but it reduces prices as the equilibrium shifts down along the supply curve. So what's happened to interest rates borrowers actually paying? The securitisation data set again provides estimates for both owner-occupiers and investors. That's pretty timely. If we look over the year to August, there's been a modest but broad-based decline in outstanding mortgage interest rates in the securitisation data set. So that suggests to me that banks were responding to weakness in credit demand by competing more vigorously over that period to provide loans to high-quality borrowers. Indeed, looking just at new loans, which I haven't shown here, but looking just at new loans, there's some evidence that the average variable interest rates declined by more for investors than owner-occupiers. So that's consistent with a noticeable decline in the demand for credit. Now, someone pointed out to me it's possible that compositional changes might also help to explain why there was a slight decline in the interest rates paid over this period. In particular, the tightening in lending standards that I've talked about, that's helped to shift the profile of loans away from higher risk borrowers. And that shift would have contributed to, at least somewhat, to the decline in average interest rates paid, as better quality borrowers tend to get loans at lower rates. But as this chart shows, it turns out that rates have declined over this period, even within the set of low-risk borrowers. And for example, shown here are those with low loan-to-valuation ratios. In other words, the decline in average rates paid that I talked about earlier has been driven by factors other than just compositional change. There are other things happening. And while banks began the process of tightening lending standards from as far back as 2015 or thereabouts, over the past year or so, they have extended these efforts by applying greater rigor to their assessments of the ability of prospective borrowers to service their loans. For example, banks have been assessing borrowers' expenditures more thoroughly, which is likely to have contributed to reductions in the maximum loan sizes that they've been offering to borrowers. Notwithstanding these changes, there are two other pieces of evidence that suggest that factors other than just a tightening in these constraints on the supply side, other factors have been affecting housing credit and housing market developments over the past year or so. So first, the majority of borrowers had earlier chosen to borrow much less than the maximum amounts offered by lenders. So reductions in the sizes of the maximum loans on offer over the past year does not imply a one-for-one reduction in credit actually extended. And second, given that owner-occupiers tend to have lower incomes on average than investors, they are likely to have faced noticeable reductions in maximum loan sizes as a result of the recent tightening in serviceability practices. However, owner-occupier credit growth has remained notably higher than investor credit growth. In summary, then, what I'm arguing is that weakness in credit demand, stemming from the dynamics in the housing market, that's been a significant development over the past year or so. And it's not to say that ongoing weakness of credit supply has not also been at work since then, but credit supply is not the only part of the story. So far I've focused on the prudentially regulated banks. While the non-banks only account for a modest share of outstanding mortgages, the sector has experienced very strong growth over recent years and is an important source of competition for the banks. As I'm sure you all know, the RMBS market is a major source of funding for non-bank providers of residential mortgages. And so RMBS issuance provides an indication of the recent growth in that sector. Last year, RMBS issuance was at its highest level since the global financial crisis. Non-banks issuance was in line, though, with the high levels issued by this sector in the mid-2000s. In 2018, RMBS issuance in aggregate has been lower, but this has been largely driven by a decreased issuance by the banks. And meanwhile, the non-banks, by contrast, are continuing to issue close to $4 billion per quarter of RMBS. It's this high volume of RMBS issuance by non-banks, well, it's consistent with a sizable increase in their mortgage lending. And it's really an unsurprising consequence of the tighter supervision and regulation of mortgage lending by banks. And this is not to say that the non-banks are unregulated. They operate under a licensing regime managed by ASIC. And as my colleague Michelle Bullock mentioned recently, the members of the Council of Financial Regulators are monitoring the growth of non-bank lenders for possible emerging financial stability risks. The Reserve Bank's liaison indicates that non-banks have been lending to some borrowers who may otherwise have obtained credit from banks in the absence of these regulatory measures. And consistent with this, the securitisation data set shows a rising share of non-bank lending, as you can see here, has been to investors. Indeed, there's been at least a 5 percentage point increase in the share of investor loans across all outstanding non-bank deals in the securitisation data set over the past 2.5 years. And this is in contrast to the share of total bank loans to investors, which, as you can see, has been declining over that period. Similarly, the share of non-bank loans that are on an interest-only basis, that share has been stable over the past couple of years, whereas the share of bank loans that are interest-only has declined significantly over the same period. But this increase in the share of investor housing in deals issued by non-banks is one of the few noticeable changes in the composition of the collateral underpinning RMBS in the past couple of years. Indeed, deals by non-banks, the share of loans with riskier characteristics such as high LVRs or self-employed borrowers, those shares have been little changed. One of the other changes to loan pools in new deals is a fall in seasoning. This has been most pronounced for non-banks. It's consistent with non-banks writing a lot more loans. Hence, the warehouses of their loans are reaching the desired issuance size much more quickly than they had in the past. Despite the pullback in RMBS issuance by the major banks over recent years, the broader stock of asset-backed securities, or ABS, of which RMBS is a large part, that stock on issue has increased by around $20 billion over the past 18 months, after remaining pretty steady for some years. Demand for these additional asset-backed securities has been driven, as you can see here, by non-residents. As well as a shift in the composition of investors in ABS, we've observed some changes in deal structures over recent years. Of particular note, the average number of tranches per deal has increased from around 4 to 8. And the increase has been broad-based across different types of issuers. And this general trend covers deals with a greater number of tranches with different levels of subordination, as well as deals where the top tranche is split into a number of individual tranches with different characteristics but equal subordination. We've also seen what we might term greater specialisation of individual tranches. For instance, in recent years, the use of one or more tranches with less common features, such as foreign currency, short-term or green features, the use of those has increased. And this increased specialisation is consistent with issuers addressing the needs of different types of investors. Anyway, all of these developments point, in my mind, to the evolution of the Australian securitisation market over the past few years, with non-bank issuers playing an increasingly important role and non-resident investors taking an increasing share of issuance. Just before I conclude, I want to make a few comments about benchmark interest rates, RMBS pricing and funding costs. The increase in bank bill swap rates in early 2018 has led to a modest rise in the funding costs of both banks and non-banks. However, the increase in overall funding costs has been a bit greater for non-bank issuers than it has been for banks. And this is because banks have a sizable proportion of their liabilities, such as retail deposits, that don't reprice in line with BBSW rates. Also, the bulk of non-bank loans are funded via RMBS issuance, and the cost of that issuance has risen by a little bit more than BBSW rates, which is what this chart shows. The premium over the BBSW benchmark rate has risen to the level of 2 years ago, and at the margin, these changes mean that non-bank issuers are not able to compete quite as aggressively on price for new borrowers as banks than was the case, say, a year ago. Now, most lenders have passed through modest increases in their funding cost to borrowers over the past few months. And despite these increases, competition for new loans remains strong, and interest rates for new loans are still well below outstanding rates. So credit supply is available to good quality borrowers on good terms, and there's a strong financial incentive for people to shop around. And one final point I'd like to make on pricing is that RMBS issuers and investors should be considering the implications of developments in interest rate benchmarks. In light of the issues around benchmarks such as LIBOR, substantial efforts have been made to reform these benchmarks, both in Australia and globally, to support the smooth functioning of the financial system. Now, in Australia, BBSW rates are important for Australian dollar interest rate benchmarks, and the one-month BBSW rate is frequently used in the securitisation market. We've been working the bank closely with the ASX and market participants to ensure that BBSW rates are anchored as much as possible to transactions in the underlying bank bill market. However, the most robust tenors are the six-month and the three-month tenors, which are the main points at which banks frequently issue bills to investors. And in contrast, the liquidity of the one-month BBSW market is lower than it once was, and this is mainly due to the introduction of liquidity standards that reduce the incentive for banks to issue very short-term paper. Given this, RMBS issuers should really consider using alternative benchmarks. One option would be to reference either the 3 or the 6 month BBSW rates for new RMBS issues. Another option is the cash rate, which is the risk-free benchmark published by the Reserve Bank. Given the underlying exposure in RMBS is to mortgages rather than to banks, it could make more sense to price those securities at a spread to the cash rate rather than to BBSW rates, which incorporate bank credit risk. And the other point to make is that issuers and investors globally, including in Australia, should be prepared for a scenario where a benchmark that they are using ceases to be published. In such an event, users would have to rely on fallback provisions in their contracts. However, for many products, including RMBS, the existing fallback provisions would be pretty cumbersome to apply. They could generate significant market disruption. This is most urgent for market participants using LIBOR, since the regulators are only supporting LIBOR until the end of 2021. And while we expect that BBSW will remain a robust benchmark, it's prudent for users of BBSW to also have robust fallbacks in place. Now, ISDA have recently conducted a consultation on how to make contracts more robust, and we would expect Australian market participants to adopt more robust fallbacks in their contracts following this consultation process. So let me just briefly conclude. As the housing market undergoes a period of adjustment, it's useful to have an understanding of some of the drivers at play. Much attention has been given to the effect of prudential measures in dampening the supply of credit and how that's affected the housing market. However, I think it's also important to acknowledge causation going in the other direction, whereby the softer housing market has led to weakness in credit demand. My assessment is that the slowing in housing credit growth over the past year or so is due to both a tightening in the supply of credit and weaker demand for credit. And within that environment, lenders are competing vigorously for high-quality borrowers. And developments in the RMBS market are consistent with non-bank lenders providing an extra source of supply. And while non-banks remain a small share of total housing lending, developments over the past couple of years show that the sector continues to evolve. And the recent increase in issuance spreads may provide some slight headwinds for the sector, but spreads still remain below their levels in early 2016. And then finally, I would just urge both issuers and investors to be responsive to the forces affecting benchmarks used to price RMBS and to focus on preparing for the use of alternative benchmarks. Thank you very much. Happy to take questions. I believe I'm in Lawrence's hands.
Yes, thanks, Chris. There are a few questions. In the interest of time, we'll take at least a couple. See what we can do. First one was around interest rate benchmarks. The RBA has expressed in the past confidence in the robustness of BBSW going forward under its new methodology. Given that you're now suggesting that securitizers could perhaps look at the cash free rate, does that confidence still apply?
Yeah, very much. I think the only thing, as I said in my speech, was the issue about the one-month BBSW rate, which is the one where there's less volumes of actual transactions supporting that rate. But the 3 and 6 month BBSW rates look quite vigorous. But the question is, You've got to pick your right benchmark for the right product. And my suggestion is that for RMBS, something like a risk-free cash rate might be more appropriate because it doesn't pick up bank credit risk.
Okay, and there are a couple of questions about non-banks, which I'll sort of unite together, I think, in the interest of time. Fundamentally, they all around the same point of whether you have any concern about the market share taken by the non-banks, any stability risks that puts into the system.
Well, I think anywhere where something is growing very fast is always somewhere that's sort of one of the first places you want to look to when thinking about financial stability risks. But they're growing very fast off a very low base. They still account for less than 5% of all housing credit. I think what's happening is they're understandably taking some borrowers who are otherwise would have gone to the banks, but that doesn't necessarily imply a reduction in the loan quality for the pools of the non-banks. It is something we're watching closely, and as best we can tell, loan arrears for the non-banks are not especially high.
Okay, and maybe just one more, so we can stay on time. There was a question about the apartment versus housing data. Given the amount of commentary around oversupply in the housing market, are you surprised that the numbers have gone that way with apartments not off as much as houses?
Well, I guess there's a caveat, which for those who are eager and want to go to the website and look at the footnote, there's plenty of footnotes in my speeches as usual. There's a footnote that talks about the fact that the data I've showed here don't capture very well the apartments sold off the plan, and we know there's probably quite a bit of weakness in that market. So the data might not be totally representative of the apartment market, although having said that, the apartments that are there and captured by the database should be reasonable substitutes for off-the-plan apartments. So I guess my point is just saying if you were so focused on the supply of credit and the weakness there driving the housing market, you might have expected apartment prices to be coming off more rapidly than house prices at the moment, detached house prices. And that graph suggested you've got to be cautious in that interpretation, and it lends support to my hypothesis that it's supply, but it's probably also demand.
Okay, maybe we'll try and get one more in if we can. Does a significant change in government tax policy create an additional unquantifiable risk to the housing market, which in some respects could remove the investor bid altogether?
Well, I think that's a question you could ask quite often, not just of Australia, but of many economies. There's always discussion about making changes in policies, including policies affecting the housing market. So I'm not sure that that's particularly elevated uncertainty at this stage. It's not clear to me.
Okay, why don't we get one more, a little more wonky one. How much is reduced seasoning in RMBS due to increased originations versus more profitable seasoned back books being kept on balance sheet?
Well, I think what we're talking here, at least, and the big reduction in seasoning was for non-banks. And my understanding, and I'm sure there's many in this room who would know this more than me, but my understanding is a large share of their funding comes from securitisation. So they're going to have to find some other source to fund those loans if they're not securitising them. I'm not sure that's something that's happening in a significant fashion.
Okay, well, thanks, Chris. I'm sure everyone wants to join me in thanking Chris, and I'll hand back to Josh. Thank you.
Thank you. Cheers. Thanks very much. Thanks, Josh.